This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled The Evolution of the World and of Humanity. This is Lecture 5. We have already gone a little into the question of dreams, and as I said yesterday, although they must not take too prominent a place in ordinary life, they are of immeasurable importance when studying the relation of man to the supersensible world. They actually lead us into that sphere of experience where man touches the supersensible world, and the external laws of nature no longer exist. Thus the world of dream pictures is really like a veil concealing the spiritual world. Here is man, one might say, and there the veil of dreams. Behind this lies the spiritual world. Now it makes a great difference whether we enter the spiritual world unconsciously, as is usually the case in ordinary life, or whether we penetrate it consciously by means of imagination and inspiration. In the latter case, everything is seen to be different from what it is in the natural physical world. Above all, behind the veil of dreams, behind that which the Greeks called chaos, the ethical, moral world is seen to be just as real as is the world of nature, the world ruled by natural laws to us here. But the chaotic nature of dreams, their confused topsy-turviness, soon makes us aware that they have a quite peculiar connection with the world behind the veil of chaos. In reality, we could hardly speak of that world at all, unless our considerations had led us as far as the subjects touched upon in yesterday's lecture. What the ordinary consciousness of man allows him to see of the external world is only its outer manifestation, which really is a great illusion. For the spiritual reality at work therein lies behind all that. As a matter of fact, when a man dreams, he dips into this spiritual reality, but without being fully prepared for it, so that what he encounters in the spiritual world is confused and strikes him as being unregulated. Our task must now be to inquire how it is that in his dreams man enters a world which, compared to the natural world, is so disordered and chaotic. To enable us to go further into the consideration of dreams, I must enlighten you a little today as to what can be discerned in the spiritual world through imagination and inspiration. As soon as we enter the spiritual world with full consciousness, through imagination and inspiration, the very first thing that appears is a triad. So that really, we can only speak of that world or of our subject, the evolution of the world and of man, at the point we have now reached in our considerations. Only now can I speak of the fact that when man confronts the external world, which is really the spiritual world manifesting physically, he is confronted with a triad. Three worlds now lie open to him. As soon as we pierce the veil of chaos, we no longer face one world, but three worlds. And these three worlds each have their own quite special relation, their own different connection with man. When we get through the veil of chaos, we perceive three worlds. Later on, I shall describe how this emerging from chaos may be regarded as a crossing of the threshold into the spiritual world. In the first place, these three worlds are really the one we have just left, which, though seen in a somewhat different form, is nevertheless also there for spiritual existence. When we have pierced the veil, it appears to us as a memory. We have entered a spiritual world. And just as we remember things here, so there too we can remember what is actually the physical sense world. That then is the first world. The second world is that described in my book Theosophy as the soul world, the world of souls. The third and highest of the three worlds is the real spiritual world. The third world is the world of the spirit. Many things concerning these three worlds will come into your minds because of the relation in which they stand to man. I shall relate man to these three worlds, which arise before you in three stages, as it were, the lowest, the middle one, and the highest. The first relates to the head, the second to the chest organism, and all that is connected with rhythm, the breathing system and the circulation of the blood. And the third to the metabolic system and limbs, and all that has to do with the transmutation of substances. For the fact that man takes nourishment, digests his food, and that the digested matter is spread through the body, and thus creates movement, shows that here we have to do with the metabolic and limb system. I can diagrammatically draw the middle body as an enclosed circle, leaving the circle of the head open, as also that of the metabolic and limb system. This is done intentionally, because to physical sight, man's head appears closed at the top, and if I were drawing this as seen physically, I should have to draw a closed circle. But to spiritual vision this is not the case, for the head is there seen to be open. That part of man which by no means belongs to the spirit land is the bone system. That is entirely of a physical nature and does not belong to the spiritual. So that if we are contemplating the human head spiritually, the solid skull does not exist at all. Nothing appears to the spiritual vision but the skin with the hair growing from it. Something else besides is seen by spiritual vision. The skull is not there at all, but spiritual hairs, rays, penetrate the skin of man's head, being only slightly hindered by the physical skin. Where the bones are in man, the external spirit can most easily penetrate, and it does so in the form of rays. So therefore, when we observe man with physical eyes and see his physical form, we see it surmounted with a head, and unless he has become bald, we see his hair. And if we could see him spiritually, we should see nothing of the physical man where the skull is convex above. We should see the spiritual world radiating into him with bright and sunny rays. So that to represent our observation of man diagrammatically, we should have to describe a man as physical being, but as spiritual being, he is nothing but numerous radiations projecting inwardly. For this reason, I have not described his head as an enclosed circle, but have left it open above, because it is a fact that the spiritual is able continuously to penetrate the human head, for the reason that it is surmounted by a bony dome. There is nothing in man that is not there for some purpose. The fact that his head is open at the top is, I might say, the result of great deliberation on the part of the cosmic rulership. For what the spirit can most easily allow to enter man comes in through that opening. Through the external bony mask, the spiritual enters the inner being of man. When we are able to observe man spiritually, we are overcome with astonishment on discovering how empty the human head is as regards his real inner being. The head gives least of all to the real inner part of man. As regards the spiritual, man has a hollow ball at the top of his body. All that is spiritual in the head has to enter it from without. This is not the case with the other parts of the human organism. These, as we shall hear later, are spiritual on their own part. We distinguish three different parts in man: the head, the rhythmic system, and the metabolic limb system. These three parts of man's nature are very specially related to the three worlds. Before passing from this feature of the threefold division of man and the threefold division of the world, and the relation of these to one another, it will be well to distinguish the nature and activity of each of these three worlds. I shall therefore describe separately the nature and activity of the spiritual world, the soul world, and the physical sense world. In reality, their nature and activity are one and the same, but their work in the world is carried out in different ways. You will be able to understand this by studying the nature of your own human being. Your arm contains your own substance. If this is not in order to have a pain in some part of it, if this is not in order, you have a pain in some part of it. What is out of order in the substance reveals itself inwardly. If the activity of your arm is out of order, you may perhaps give your fellow man a blow which hurts him. In this case, the activity is out of order. But although the substance and the activity in your arm are one, they manifest outwardly in different ways. We must therefore distinguish a substance as well as an activity in each of the three worlds. There is activity and substance in the spiritual world, soul world, and physical sense world. Now, when we observe the human head, we see that, as regards its substance, it is entirely built up out of the physical world. The substance of the head is taken during the embryonic formation from the substance provided by the parents. And the further development of the head comes about as the result of the substance of this earthly material world, which underlies the whole nervous system and senses of the human head. The head is formed of the substance of the physical sense world. On the other hand, all the activity which plastically creates these forms of the human head, all that gives form to the human head through the activity working in the substance, comes wholly and absolutely from the spiritual world. The head, therefore, in so far as the activity is concerned, is entirely formed from the spiritual world. That is why the head must remain open above, spiritually speaking, to admit the spiritual activity. Thus, at every moment of your lives, you can say to yourselves, "My head is something which, as regards its substance, is wholly taken from the earth, but it is put together and plastically modeled in a way which could never be done by the forces of earth. The forms of activity of this human head were entirely modeled in the spiritual world. They are, so to speak, heavenly creations." It makes a very deep impression on the spiritual observer when he contemplates the human head in its connection with the cosmos. If in the course of his spiritual observations the student directs his gaze to a plant, he says, "This plant has a definite form. It has drawn its substance from the earth, but its form comes from the etheric world, from the world of space." If he contemplates an animal, he says, "This animal has received the substance of its head wholly from the world of space, but in its activity there is certainly something spiritual. The highest spirituality, however, that which can really be called heavenly, only plays a part in the construction of the head of man. The human head could never have come into being through any earthly forces whatsoever, although its substance is drawn from earthly material. In the human head, which is itself a sort of little cosmos, the spiritual world constructs a form with the substance of earth. Just the reverse is the case as regards the metabolic limb part of man, that part which contains the organs for external movement, the legs, arms, and the organs of digestion, which are the inner continuation of these. I shall, for the present, leave the middle man out of consideration, the rhythmic system, the breathing system, and the circulation of the blood, and shall chiefly consider the digestive and nutritive system, and all the movements going on in man as the result of inner combustion. As far as the substance of this man is concerned, it is in no wise built up from the earth. Strange as it may seem, in your metabolic and limb man you bear within you something which, as regards its substance, is not built up from the earth, but is entirely composed of substance derived from the third world, substance existing in the spiritual world. You may object, "But I can see my legs. They are physically visible." If they really consisted of spiritual substance, they would not be physically visible. This objection is quite justifiable, but the following must be taken into consideration. Your real legs are entirely spiritual. Your real arms are entirely spiritual. The substance is sent down into them from your head. The head is the organ that fills the spiritual arms and hands, the spiritual legs and feet, with substance. And the spiritual part of the limbs and organs of digestion is simply permeated with that. The substance which comes wholly from the spiritual world is permeated with physical substance coming from the head. That is what makes it so difficult at first, to understand through physical science that man consists of head, chest, and limbs, and organs of digestion. People picture it thus. The head is above, situated just where a man who has been beheaded has nothing left at all. That, however, is not the case. As regards its substance, the head is in all parts of a man, even in his great toe. The head sends down its substance into the toes. Primarily, however, the head is composed of earthly substance and passes the earthly substance on to the rest of the body. But the actual substance of the metabolic system and limbs comes only from the spiritual world. If we are able, by means of strong negative autosuggestion, to suggest away a man's head, so that not only in thought but through autosuggestion we really see him as headless, the rest of him disappears too. With the head disappears that which man is, as a physically perceptible being. We must then see the rest psychically and spiritually, if it is apparent at all. For in reality we go about provided with spiritual arms and legs, our head alone being filled and permeated to a certain extent with physical substance. On the other hand, the forces, the activity in every part of the metabolic and limb man are taken from the physical world. When we move an arm or a leg by means of forces of leverage obedient to the laws of mechanics, these forces, and even the chemical processes in the arms and legs or organs of digestion, are all earthly activities. Thus, while we have invisible substances in our limbs, we also have forces drawn from earth existence. As human beings, we are, in regard to our head and the substances within it, of the earth, earthly. But in regard to that same head, we are permeated with heavenly forces. As regards our limbs, we are wholly composed of a substance descended from heaven. But the forces that play in that heavenly substance during the earth life from birth to death are the forces of earth, gravitation and other physical forces of the earth, the chemical forces of the earth. You see that in the head and limbs exactly opposite processes are carried out. The head is composed of earthly substances, while it owes its plastic form to heavenly activities. The limbs of man and his digestive organs are wholly constructed by heavenly organizing. We could not see them at all were they not permeated with earthly substance coming from the head. When a man walks or grasps things with his hands, when he digests, the heavenly substance makes use of the earthly forces with which to carry on this life on earth from birth to death. Such is the complicated relation of man to the three worlds. The most spiritual of these takes part, as regards its activity, in the head of man, and as regards its substance, it takes part in the third system of man's organization, the metabolic and limb system. The lowest and most physical of the three worlds takes part, as regards its activity, in the metabolic system and movement of man's limbs. As regards its substance, it takes part in his head. On the other hand, the substance of the third part of man's system is wholly and entirely spiritual. In the middle system, that of the breathing and circulation of the blood, spiritual activity and material substance are intermingled. But the spiritual activity which pours through our breathing movements and the movements of our heart is again, to some extent, accompanied by substantiality, as also the substantiality of the earthly being, insofar as it streams into the breathing with the oxygen, is to some extent accompanied by earthly activity. So you see that in the middle man, the second human system, there is a mingling. Both heavenly substance and heavenly activity pour in, as also do earthly activity and earthly substance. Man thereby becomes liable to receive the activity of the middle world as well as its substance. Thus in the middle man there is a great medley, which is the reason that we must have in the middle man that wonderful perfect rhythmic system, the rhythm of the heart and the rhythm of the lungs in breathing, for all the confused intermingling of substance and activity has to be brought into rhythm, harmonized, and rendered melodious. This can be done because man is so organized. Thus, whereas activity and substance stream from different sources into the head system and the limb system, there flows into the middle system in various ways from all three worlds. From world one, activity accompanied by substantiality. From world two, substantiality accompanied by activity. From world three, pure activity and pure substantiality. When you feel a man's pulse medically, you really feel the adjustment between the heaven soul and the earthly activity and substantiality. When you observe the human breathing, here again, you feel the inward striving to adjust these different agencies, which are in relation to man in his middle being. That, then, is the relation of man to the three worlds. You will explain that this is a very complicated matter. Certainly, when one has carried a series of lectures to this point, they are, as a rule, thus far comparatively easy to understand. But when it becomes necessary to grasp the relation of man to the cosmos, the audience is very apt to say that the subject is now becoming very difficult to follow, that it is beyond them. Yet, clear, subtle thinking, free from prejudice, such as belongs to healthy human reason, is really able to follow, and for such there is one consolation. When a man actually passes through the veil of chaos, to which I previously alluded, when he enters the threefold world which sends down into the physical world its activity and its substance in so complete a fashion, when, leaving the physical behind, he enters the world in which things are so bewildering, he is warned in the fullest sense of the words. And though I may seem to be speaking symbolically, this really represents a spiritual experience. On entering the spiritual world, he is told, "If you do not leave behind you all that you looked upon as your ordinary natural logic and what you regarded as the natural connection of things, it were better not to enter the spiritual world. For there you will have to make use of quite different sequences of ideas, quite different systems, quite different logic. If you still wish to take something of your physical logic into the spiritual world, you will unquestionably fall into utter confusion." Close quote. To the other things which I have already mentioned as necessary for meditation and concentration, this warning must be added, namely, we must not try to carry logic into the spiritual world. That, I might say, is the most significant warning which is given by the power of whom we shall learn more in the subsequent lectures, and whom we may call the guardian of the threshold. That is the warning which the guardian of the threshold gives us as soon as we try to pass through the curtain. When we wish to return into the physical sense world, the guardian again gives us a clear and mighty warning. As earth men, we must turn back again, or we shall never get away from the events of the spiritual world, and gradually our physical bodies would be left behind to die. We must always return. We must eat and drink in the physical world. That is natural logic. Indeed, we must fulfill the other customs of the day according to that same logic. We must re-enter a world in which things run their daily course according to a quite natural and materialistic logic. For example, a bell calls us to breakfast, luncheon, and dinner. We must return into this natural world. It is, however, necessary that having penetrated into the spiritual world, we should, if we do not want to be in an impossible position, take heed of the second warning given by the guardian of the threshold, who stands at the place where the veil of chaos divides the physical sensible from the spiritual heavenly world. The warning he gives is as follows, quote, "Not for a single moment of your earth life must you forget that you have been in the spiritual world. Thus only can you go about securely in the physical earth world during the times you have to abide there." Close quote. Thus on entering the world with which man, as I have shown, is connected through the three divisions of his person. We are warned to lay aside everything of the nature of natural logic, to leave that physical vestment at the threshold, and pass across it fully determined to acquire a true spiritual logic, a spiritual mode of thought, and a spiritual sequence of ideas. On returning, we are given just as strict, nay, an even stricter warning, never for a single moment to forget what we have experienced in the spiritual world, which means we must not in our ordinary consciousness yield to physical impulses, but be in all things conscious that it has been laid upon us to carry the spiritual truths into this physical world. As you see, the two warnings are quite different from each other. At the entrance into the spiritual world, the guardian of the threshold says, quote, "During the time of spiritual cognition, forget the physical sense world." Close quote. On leaving the spiritual for the physical sense world, the guardian of the threshold says, quote, "In the physical earth world, never forget, but always remember your experiences in the spiritual heavenly world." Close quote. With respect to this, there is a considerable difference between the humanity of an earlier epoch of man's evolution and present-day man. Those men of whom I spoke as having approached the teachers in the old mysteries, either as inspired pupils or as the general humanity of that time, did not pass over from sleeping to waking or from waking to sleeping without becoming aware of the guardian of the threshold in their psychic spiritual instincts. As those men of 3,000 or 4,000 years ago passed from the waking state into the sleep, the picture of the guardian of the threshold arose in their souls as in a dream. They went past him. This picture arose again as they returned from sleep into ordinary life. The warning they received on entering and leaving the spiritual world was not so distinct as it is received by those who now make their way into that spiritual world by means of imagination and inspiration. But they had an experience of having passed the guardian on falling asleep and waking. And this was of a dreamlike nature, as were the rest of their instinctive experiences of the spiritual world. The further evolution of man consisted, as we shall see in the lectures still to be given, in the loss of his psychic spiritual vision, for only thus could he acquire his freedom. The further development of man consists in his having lost that sleeping, dreaming, waking state, which is halfway between sleeping and waking, and during which, as also in the halfway state between waking and sleeping, he was able to see the majestic guardian of the threshold, even though only as in a dream. Today man passes the guardian both when falling asleep and when waking, but he is not aware of him, and disregards his presence. That is why the man of today enters a totally disorganized world of dreams. Just consider in an unprejudiced way in how different a fashion men of the older periods spoke of their dreams, from what is the custom today. Because every morning and every evening, and every time he falls asleep in the afternoon, the man of today twice ignores the guardian. He experiences the disorder and chaos of his dream world, as is apparent in the different configurations of his dreams. Just consider, whenever we cross the threshold, as we do every time we fall asleep, the majestic guardian stands at that threshold. He cannot be ignored, without the result that all we encounter in the spiritual world falls into a state of confusion. This is evident in the metamorphosis that takes place there when the well-ordered thought of the natural physical world passes into the fabric of the dream. We can observe this clearly in certain dreams. Now, in the physical natural world, we behave as the conditions have taught us to do. Let us take a particular case. A man goes for a walk. Why does he go out walking? Well, in the present day, people living in cities take certain walks because of the experiences they have there. They meet their acquaintances. If such be their tendency, they allow their dresses to be seen by others, by people they do not know as well as by those they do, All these are experiences met with on their walks. These experiences we have through being able to think and imagine with our fellow men, because we are able with our head, or rather with the organization of our head, to say, I think. In the power of I think lies the possibility of having experiences in the external world, such as I have just described. One meets other people. That is an experience for them. One shows one's dresses, or perhaps one's pretty face. The point is what one really experiences. But in the act of seeing other people, and letting them see something of us, we have certain feelings. One thing may please us, another not. We thus develop likes and dislikes. We are pleased if the persons we meet on our walk say things with which we agree. We are not pleased if they say something of which we do not approve. We meet that with antipathy. So that what we experience on our walk is entirely connected with opinions actuated by the head through I think. That which the rhythmic man develops as I feel is connected with feeling, with sympathy and antipathy. Thus, because we are also able, in a second part of our being, to say I feel, we accompany with feeling what we experience by reason of what we see in our walk. The third part of man also takes part in this walk if we are wide awake. Here we must touch on certain intimacies of human experience. We have the feeling that it is impossible, in our modern civilization, to let ourselves be seen by others in an unclothed state, or to go for a walk without clothes. We feel antipathy for the unclothed state, while we are sympathetic to the fully dressed condition. This goes over into the impulses of will. We dress ourselves, and indeed we dress ourselves in a certain way. That is brought about by the will, the third member of man's organization. The fact that we dress ourselves depends on the third part of man. It comes from our being able to say, I will. The act of dressing originates in an impulse of will. I think, I feel, I will. Thus, because we are able to say, I will, we go out for our walk fully clothed. That is the result of I will. All this, in the physical world in which we dwell when awake, is ordained as the result of logic. It is either inculcated into us, or we adapt ourselves to the conditions of life provided externally in the physical world by logic. If we do not do so, something in us must be out of order. If we go out for a walk with nothing on, something must be out of order. The order of the physical world, known as logic, keeps things in their place. We should certainly never wish to meet other people in an unclothed state when we go for a walk. Here there is sequence in our soul experiences, not brought about by ourselves, but by the cohesion of the world. This is the result of the three, I think, I feel, I will, being in connection with one another. The world does that. The external world causes us to set up this connection between thinking, feeling, and willing. Now, if we cross the threshold without having observed the guardian of the threshold, we are confronted with the three worlds and cannot, at first, find our bearings in them. That is partly because we carry over into the other, the spiritual world, that to which we are here accustomed, and partly because the order of that world makes itself felt. And the following occurs. Suppose you are asleep in bed, with your feeling part, with the middle part of man. You take part in this sleeping condition. The clothes may fall off, and a part of your body become chilled. This comes through into your dream consciousness, because that part of your body is unclothed. Now, because you cannot find your bearings in the spiritual world, and you are not able to connect this with one part only of your body, but related to the whole world, it expands into the feeling, I am naked. Perhaps the clothes may have only slipped off a part of your body, but you are a little chilly in that part, and you feel that you are naked. But now, you have just been occupied in your dream with the impulse of will you would have were you awake. If I am naked, I must put on some clothes. And in your sleep you feel, I cannot put my clothes on. I am being prevented from doing so. That is because you cannot move your limbs, and this enters your dream consciousness. You see, because you have lost your bearings, and the physical world is no longer there to connect the two things together, and because the one belongs to world two, and the other to world one, you connect them wrongly. The night you dream that you go for a walk, you add these experiences to the other. They come up separately in your dream consciousness. Three separate conditions appear. I am taking a walk, I am unclothed, and this is very obnoxious to me, and I cannot put on my clothes. Now just think, these three things, which in the ordinary materialistic physical life can be logically connected, are divided and have no connection if you have passed the guardian of the threshold without perceiving him. In world one, physical, the walk. In world two, psychic or soul, the state of nakedness. In world three, spiritual, the feeling that you cannot dress yourself, that it is quite impossible to do so. And now you feel yourself in a threefold condition, in the following situation. You are among strange people in a state of nakedness. You are exposed to all eyes. You are quite unable to put your clothes on. All this you experience in your dream. The dream divides what in ordinary life would be logically connected. And you connect this chaotically, according to the habits you have carried over the threshold. As though things were the same in the spiritual world, as though one could be naked there, and so on. If you pass the guardian without being aware of him, you carry the habits of the physical into the spiritual worlds. You connect the three worlds together in a chaotic way, according to the usages and laws of the physical world, and feel yourself in the above-mentioned situation. The essential point in numberless dreams is that the moment we pass the threshold, not having heeded the warning of the guardian, all that here in the natural physical world is felt and perceived as unity in harmony, as harmonious unity, separates, and we are confronted with three worlds. By the faithful observation of the warning given by the guardian of the threshold, we should be able to unite them again. The dreams of present-day man bring him face to face with three worlds, which he, as modern man, seeks to unite according to the laws of physical and natural existence. And this brings about the disordered connection within these three worlds, in which man now is. The above does not so much apply to the men of earlier epochs, as can be seen by the dreams recorded in the Old Testament, but rather to the dreams of modern man. So you see, that even dreams can show us the serious fact that the moment we cross the threshold of the spiritual world, we are immediately confronted with three worlds, and that we must both enter and leave these three worlds in the right way. Through dreams, modern man can learn much that is characteristic of the present physical sense world, as also of the other, the spiritual soul world. We shall speak further of these matters tomorrow. The end of Lecture 5.